So it's the middle of the night there. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, the first speaker we have is Gene Lukianoff, who's an auto engineer and technical specialist, and welcome from the EMS Safety Foundation.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to be here and to talk. I'm sort of outside the EMS culture. I come from the automotive side of the world, but try to do a little bit, introduce everybody. Can that better? Okay. I'll try to talk a little bit from the automotive side and relate it to the ambulance and EMS side. So how do I make this thing go? Okay, this is the wrong presentation. Well, we need to go back, and on that slide where all the presentations are, it's the very first presentation in the list. Very, very first one. Okay, what I'll be, yep, perfect, thank you. What I'll be talking about is bridging the ergonomics operational task analysis with automotive safety. And my associate, Chris Fitzgerald, I guess, will be speaking after me or sometime during the day, being beamed in from Australia. Of course, we're going to have a few definitions in the beginning. I'll share some automotive safety technology insights with the group. I'll talk about the challenge that the ambulance industry has in relation to safety. We'll talk about bridging the gap ergonomically and with automotive safety. And I'm going to share some opportunities that I see as an engineer. Engineer always has some opinions of what to do. I'm not going to read this slide, but what's ergonomics? And this is Chris's bailiwick, not mine. But the most important thing is sort of the middle thing. Ergonomics is a scientific discipline that's understanding the internet interactions between humans and other elements of the system. And there's two goals: health and productivity. We don't hurt ourselves, and we get the job done efficiently. From an automotive safety point of view, sort of my specialty, there's two parts. Over the past 20, 30 years, the industry and the government has concentrated on passive safety. When vehicles crash, what happens? That's why seat belts, that's why airbags, that's why structure of vehicles. But now, in the past 5 years or so, active safety has arisen. How do you prevent accidents from happening? You can prevent it, that's a wonderful thing. Everybody, the life moves on. So, and there's been a tremendous increase in technology available for active safety thanks to electronics. Active safety, this is the kind of stuff you avoid. You don't start getting into an accident and you prevent this, the physical damage and destruction that occurs. From a safety technology, from an active safety technology, tremendous amount of stuff, like I said, that's been coming up. Stability control systems have been introduced and now federally mandated for all vehicles under 10,000 pounds. Stability control systems apply the brakes automatically, stabilize vehicles before the driver even knows that it's going out of control. It's a tremendous improvement in safety. It looks like it's as strong, if not stronger, than seat belts, which have been around since the 60s. Unfortunately, ESC is only required on vehicles under 10,000 pounds. In other words, if you've got four rear tires, you don't have ESC. And the federal government's working on ESC for over-the-highway trucks, the 18-wheelers. And they've got them on the lighter vehicles. The kinds of vehicles that ambulances are being built on, the duallys, they're out of the picture right now. And I don't know of any government plans to add ESC to that middle range of trucks. Other stuff that's coming up, anti-skid braking's already in here. There's active braking that's coming up where the brakes actually start applying at the last instance before an accident, a crash happens, slowing the vehicle down. There's traction control, there's backup cameras, there's night vision. Questionable about how much the benefit all this technology will have, we'll know over time what's the best things. But ESC is absolutely a big thing. There's also pre-crash safety that's coming up. Before an accident happens, the seatbelts get tighter. Or, like I said, automatic braking. Passive technology, there's seatbelts. We're very familiar with them. There's airbags all over the place. There's laminated windshields. There's crumple zones on production vehicles, side impact protection, collapsible steering columns, integrity for doors and steer and hinge systems. Now there's passenger protective systems coming up to avoid, especially in Europe, impact-friendly surfaces. That's something key to talk about in ambulances in the back, and cargo restraints. A little bit of discussion of what goes on in the automotive world to design for safety. That whole interior is designed to protect the passengers. What we deal with there is we've got very well-defined occupant positions. The occupants aren't moving around in the back of a vehicle. It's highly refined. All the surfaces are designed to absorb impacts. And if you sit in your own car and you feel around the edges, on the A-pillars, the roofs, those surfaces are actually hard plastic surfaces. They're not softly padded. They're not comfort surfaces. They're there to absorb impacts if your body happens to strike them. In the automotive world, we're dealing with high-volume manufacturing. 50,000 vehicles is a small volume in the automotive world. Right now, we've got 50,000 ambulances total in the States, and we're manufacturing about 5,000 ambulances a year. Huge, huge difference in volumes. So the automotive industry has a high capital investment capability and a huge testing and certification process that the ambulance companies just can't afford. As I said, the ambulance challenge, they're small manufacturers, minimal research funding. It's very much a working environment in the back as opposed to a sitting still environment. Very high stress situations if you're involved in with a desperately ill patient. Many variations in the tasks in the back, and there's a tremendous amount of equipment sitting in the back of an ambulance that's needed for whatever the work that needs to be done. It's basically an emergency room on wheels. You know, we look at that Cadillac earlier in the program. That looked like a transportation machine to transport a passenger, an ill passenger. When we've got a huge room on the back of wheels, we're literally talking an emergency room. You know, maybe it's time to rethink that. Should it be a transport system or should it be actually an emergency room? And interestingly, in that slide on the bottom left, in the hospital, people are standing up and working on patients. Not a good thing in the ambulance. We're sitting beside an ambulance, beside the patient in the ambulance. And these days we're seated and we're restrained. But can we actually get the job done? To bridge the gap between ergonomics and automotive safety, let's compare the two. On the left-hand side is ergonomics. On the right-hand side is automotive safety. Our primary goal, maintain health and safety and productivity. That's very similar between both disciplines. We've got a huge range of customers, both patients and operators. And these days, we promote being seated in both industries, automotive as well as ambulances. But in ergonomics, we've got a tremendous amount of work to do in the back of the ambulance. We've got to reach equipment. We've got to reach the patients. We've got to be strong enough. And there's repetitive events. In the automotive side, we're basically asking the passengers to sit still, be quiet, get strapped in, and if the vehicle crashes, just you're going to bounce around, but you'll walk away. So one hand sitting still, one hand being very busy in the back. Major difference. But there are opportunities. If we look at the, I'm going to talk about four of them and illustrate it a little bit. The attendant-patient relationship, operator support systems, interior and equipment storage, and I'll mention operating factors. The patient relationship with the operator. We're sitting beside the patient now. Forward-facing seats are very appropriate for crash safety, but the patient's beside you. In the hospital, it seems like people are facing the patient. Now we're looking forwards, working on the patient beside us. Is that really an ergonomic thing? Or should we be looking toward the patient, still strapped in, and working on the patient? It's a challenge. I don't have an answer. I'm raising a point. And then the gurneys, there's no room for the knees of an operator underneath the patient. When you're standing up beside the hospital bed, your knees are not in the way. You happen to have your knees in the way these days. But doesn't mean it can't be solved. It means it needs to be recognized first, and then solutions will come along. Support systems. What I'm talking about is the handrails. On the left-hand side is a typical automotive handle. It's plastic. If your head hits, it's not that big a deal. On an ambulance, I love those steel rails. You know, they're appropriate for the bathtub, maybe. But if you're bouncing around inside that ambulance, do you want your head to be hitting that steel rail? I'm not totally sure of that one. Interiors. I've mentioned the car interior, designed for head impacts, knee impacts, femur impacts, whatever. Ambulances are basically rooms on wheels or kitchens on wheels, lots of cabinets. Sharp corners, hard surfaces. Do those drawers even stay closed as the vehicle happens to be in an accident? And operating factors, operator fatigue. When I visited an ambulance service, spent some time with them, I was stunned that these folks are working 14, 18, 20-hour shifts, sleeping in the back of ambulances. Medical services, driver fatigue. If you drive 14 hours, you're wiped at the end. And we're supposed to be providing medical services and lights and sirens. And then lights and sirens, that's another point. As I was talking to the folks, who determines lights and sirens? They were telling me it's the dispatchers. Somebody's sitting in Ypsilanti talking to somebody in Detroit saying, yeah, turn your lights and sirens on. Well, can't you decide not to? It's not a situation you need it to. No, they've told us to have the lights and sirens on. We have to do that. So I don't know enough about the rules of engagement, but when people love to have run with lights and sirens just because, it's starting to set up a culture of, you know, situations being set up that can result in accidents. So that's my engineering perspective. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Joining us from Australia, I have the destination correct now, is Chris Fitzgerald, who is RMS EMS Safety Director, Human Factors, and he actually is an ergonomist.
Just so folks know, it's probably about 1:30 in the morning in Australia, and Chris was really delighted when I suggested we were having a one-day summit and that I wanted him to speak twice. And so he'll be probably taking a little nap between this presentation and his next one as we're just setting up to hand over the microphone so that Chris Fitzgerald is able to join you. Whilst we're doing that, I'm just going to tell you a little aside about Chris Fitzgerald. As those of you who don't know me can tell, I do have an accent, I'm told. Personally, I think you all have accents, but I have an Australian accent, and as you're going to hear when Chris speaks, he shares the same accent. Chris, we're going to do a little sound test on you in just a moment.
Okay.
There you go, loud and clear. There we have it. So,
can you hear me now?
Crystal clear, Chris. Okay. Loud and clear. You sound perfect. I'm going to turn off this microphone and we'll catch up on the story of how I know Chris Fitzgerald later, but it was not in Australia that we met. Could you just speak up a little bit louder?
Yeah, no problem at all. Perfect. I have that now.
You need to do something to your slide. Oh, you need to show your PowerPoint presentation, I'm told. On your computer?
So am I.
On your computer, believe it or not. So whilst Chris is finding his PowerPoint presentation on his computer, I will tell you how I met Chris. I was at an ergonomics...
Okay.
You've got it?
Yep, I know what to do now. Just give me one sec.
I'll just give them a little introduction to where I met you. It was at an ergonomics conference, and I'd heard that there was this Australian ergonomist who'd been involved in designing neonatal and pediatric ambulances, and I thought, wow, how cool is that? So I asked everybody that I could find at the conference who had an Australian accent if they knew this guy, Chris Fitzgerald. So I went up to this gentleman and I said to him, excuse me, just wondering, I heard you've got a bit of an Australian accent. You wouldn't happen to know Chris Fitzgerald, would you? He said, I am Chris Fitzgerald. And I thought, oh, how cool is that? So I actually did first meet Chris in Maastricht, where he was presenting some information related to this field. Chris is probably the world's preeminent EMS ergonomist, and we're extremely fortunate to have him join us today. He's probably done more work in the field of ergonomics as it pertains to emergency services than any other person on the planet. So I'm honoured that you're staying up to 1:30 in the morning to join us. Your slides are ready to go. If you need assistance flicking them over, do let us know, and we'll go from there. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks, Nadine. I appreciate that kind introduction. All of my years of ergonomics experience may not be helping me at this point to advance the slide. So I've booted that up from my machine. Is that what I was meant to do?
I hope so.
Yep. I'm just trying to advance the slides and I'm not able to.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll advance to the next slide for you.
Oh. If you're able to, that'd be great.
Oh, hang on. No. Just use the arrow key, I'm told.
I must admit, Chris, I didn't sort of perform all that well in the slide advancing approach too.
Do the arrow keys work, or the up or down, is it, or left or right?
Yep.
Spacebar. Try spacebar. Spacebar.
Just tried spacebar. I've just trying page down. I'll try the arrow key. It gives me a pause function. I don't seem to have...
Maybe computers in Australia are upside down. We might have to help him turn the slides.
They are.
Could we open that PowerPoint from our computer and help him turn the slides? Yes, I think that might be helpful. We're just doing that, Chris, hopefully.
Okay, no problem.
So while we're waiting for that, I'll tell you a little bit more about the presentation that's going to follow that Chris will give us later. And it's going to be going through some examples of applying this these principles of ergonomics to the actual design and building of fleets of ambulances. So these aren't concept vehicles. These are operational vehicles that are parts of large fleets in a number of places around the world. And what Chris is going to walk you through in this session is the basic principles of the ergonomics that... we appear to have changed the slide. We're going to do it for...
Can you still hear me?
You just have to say next. When you want a next slide, just do next. How's that, Chris?
That's fabulous. Yep, that's great. I appreciate that. Okay, so let's keep moving. So thanks for the introduction. Nadine's correct. I've had the good fortune of being able to be involved extensively in Australia and more recently in some European and North American jurisdictions on the design of ambulances and a lot of equipment and patient handling methods in particular. I'm just sort of starting with some sort of contemporary sort of images of some of our specialist response vehicles that have emerged over the last 6 years. Do you want to proceed to the next slide? Very good. So just in terms of an overview of what I'm going to present today, just quickly as elements of ergonomics factors relevant to ambulance design, I'm very much focusing on the physical layout, particularly of the ambulance within and to a lesser degree around the periphery of the ambulance. There's a whole range of other ergonomics factors with regard to visibility, conspicuity, but I'm very much speaking about physical ergonomics today. A big component I want to present to you is really about operational task analysis, so we're understanding what is done, some information about body sizing and anthropometry and biomechanics of human movement, and then putting that into context, as Gene has indicated in his presentation, about sort of the fundamentals of automotive safety and occupant protection, which really override will take precedent over fundamental ergonomic changes, and then putting all that together in terms of building an ambulance. So we go to the next slide. Okay, so as Gene indicated, he's given you the definition from the International Ergonomics Association, and really just to sort of summarise those key points, it really is about interactions of humans within a system, and that's humans between humans, as well as physical elements and the environment that, in which the system operates. And it really, a big component of the purpose of ergonomics is really about optimising human well-being and behaviour, and particularly system performance. And it's an important component because a lot of the presentation of my information in this arena is really from a safety base, but it really should be much broader than that. Safety is clearly a key and paramount priority. But system performance, which can be a bit harder to define in terms of human behaviour, but it's vital, and ergonomics can have a sort of contribution to that. But it's an iterative approach, and essentially I'm about to give you some technical information, but as you'll see by many of my slides that provide supporting visual references for that, a lot of it is about the engagement with people who perform the work, and it's really aligning the science or providing the science about human factors that to give greater understanding about what they do and how they do it and how they best might do it. So it's really on providing technical information, but I want to make sure it's clear that it's in the context of people who run the system, basically. So in terms of the physical factors of ergonomics that I want to touch on today is really the top of the list is really task analysis, and that's defining what people do. Anthropometry, body size, and biomechanics. The other elements that are listed below there are irrelevant, but I'm focusing on those three. Next slide. Thank you. So really task analysis, and in sort of preparing for this presentation, I sort of reflected on that, and it's a major platform of my practice. When I first was invited to review the design of two ambulances in 1999, so that's some time ago, I had no idea what to do. So what I did is I defined the interactions between the paramedics and every aspect of the system within that ambulance. So essentially I established about 1,000, 1,200 sort of task steps that define those interactions, and I then conducted essentially audits of two different ambulance designs. And we had sort of comparative information that helped us consolidate the design and move forward. That's the interesting thing about task analysis. It really does give you the chance to define what do people do, but you do end up with a lot of data. You'll end up with a lot of information. But it sort of helps sort of design those parameters. And one of those earlier presenters was talking about sort of safety culture and behavioural outcomes. I tell people when my kids tell people when they say, what does your dad do? And I'm about anticipating people's behaviour and trying to manage what they will do through design. So very much the design approach is trying to sort of anticipate and restrain the limited or limit the poor decision-making opportunities for people. And good design, you can see it, and usually it will sort of testify to that. So in practical terms, you're really defining it. And another element of task analysis is really defining what people do without judgment. So you're not looking at risks, you're not looking at hazards, you're just simply defining what people do, and then you come back to that data set and you start to interrogate it in terms of what's the implication of what people do. To give you an example of a typical, just reaching into a cupboard or a locker within an ambulance to grab some item and use it could in fact involve 7 or 8 task steps. So someone has to reach to the locker, they have to unlatch it, they have to open the locker, they may have to hold the locker open with one hand while they reach into the locker. They may have to release an item that's restrained or locate it to then remove it. And once they've got the item, they might have to prepare it for use. They might use it. They might have to pack it up or clean it before putting it back. But that whole sort of sequence of interaction, and I know Dr. Levick loves citing a classic example of, you know, grabbing a blood pressure cuff from an elastic holster that, you know, on the other side of the stretcher where that was all easily done, but when it came time to put the device back into its storage unit, you needed two hands. So people were releasing their seatbelts to be able to open the holster switch. So task analysis can reveal that type of sensitive information about what. And once you have those that information, you can then start to say, well, what do we need to do? What are the interactions? What are the engagements with people? And the next slide demonstrates some of those in very practical terms. So next slide, please. Thank you. So this is the early phases of the development of a complex patient ambulance. This slide's about 7 years old now. And we were dealing with, we're trying to design an ambulance for high acuity patients and also the bariatric, you know, the very large patient. And we really had very limited experience. We had great experience in standard general purpose responses and in some specialist areas, but not this area. So we actually grabbed the van. It's a large Mercedes van. And we made significant cardboard cutouts, and we defined our likely positioning and scenarios. And so we conducted our task analysis to understand our interactions. And if you go to the next slide, it reveals some of the outcomes of that. And there we go. There's the ambulance at the end of it. So clearly somewhat different to our initial concept, but our initial concept gave us a good basis to move forward, and that was largely based on task analysis. If you go to the next slide, please. You can also see some basic sort of fundamental rules of occupant protection being applied here, such as forward-facing seat. And again, this was a seat, rear-facing seat. Next slide, please. You see we've scribbled on everything. We've defined our sort of first response locker. We've defined our seating requirements. As we see in the next slide. Eventually, it's revealed as an ambulance with a certain degree of functionality. Okay, next slide, please. So that's trying to sort of give you a sense of this is real world. So we're sort of using technical data to engage with people. And with that particular ambulance, we built that in 2006. We revised the design in 2010. And we didn't change very much at all. Our capacity to anticipate the design requirements of that ambulance were very strong because our methodology of trying to understand what was needed, I believe, was very strong. So I'll just touch on anthropometry, which is really interesting, a key part of ergonomics, which talks about body size. And really our key applications within the ambulance environment is who are we designing for with regard to our patients? So what size patients in terms of our capacity to accommodate and restrain them and transport them. And then also, very importantly, our paramedics and other occupants who may need to be in the ambulance from time to time. A key consideration of anthropometry in ambulance is that the gender participation, if you could just go back one slide, please. The gender participation in ambulance has really gone from 10 or 15 years ago to being largely a male dominated industry. If we can just reverse the direction a couple of us, great. Thank you very much. And really, many services across the world, and I believe this is consistent with the US and North America, is that we're getting participation rates of, you know, approaching 50-50 in terms of male to female. I know in my service in the state of Victoria, so we're about a population of about 4.5 million people, we've reached 45%, but our recruitment rate female is 70%. So I'm expecting that we'll exceed the 50-50 balance within the next 2 years. And with that goes a whole range of issues in terms of that need to be reflected in design. So the reality about gender difference is body height, body size, as we'll see in the next slides for some features, and also some strength capability, particularly in terms of upper limb strength. Here we have body size. Here's some images provided to me by Dr. Kathleen Robinette, probably this little lead anthropometrist globally. Dr. Robinette coordinated the CSER project, which was the first major 3D scanning project about 10 or 12 years ago. And if you see on the left image, you can see sort of an overlay. The green is a male, 99th percentile for hip, and overlaid with a female for the same dimension. As you can see, the female's hips are clearly wider than the male's, but if you go to the upper body, clearly the male's body are wider than the female. So when we're designing some of those accommodation issues for seating, we really have to now account for both data sets with regard to those variables. And if you see some of the subtlety in the slide on the image on the right, you'll see that those two females, their overlaid images, have the same seated body height, but clearly they've got very different three-dimensional torso dimensions that really need to be accommodated. And we could say that, you know, how many paramedics might fit that bill, and you'd have to reflect on your own service in terms of the body size of your own population. It's also interesting to note there for the light green person how her foot is much higher, and that's not just the leg length difference, but that's a reflection of the larger person. They've got more tissue under their femur, so their effective leg length is sitting short. So if we go to the next slide, please. Okay, so here's a practical measure, Charlene. I believe Charlene's in the room there. Hello, Charlene. So this was Charlene participating, probably around about a 40th percentile female, just for a demonstration at a workshop we ran in Dallas several years ago. So this is real world. That's why I've shown some people. It's not just about imaging. Next slide, please. And again, the anthropometric data can be extended to understand functional task performance and biomechanics. These are just some slides, again, provided by Dr. Robinette, and they relate to more cockpit design in terms of the US Air Force, but they we can easily extrapolate what they're communicating in terms of reach capabilities for rear of ambulance design. And when you look at this type of image, it reeks one issue, and that is, as Jean Lukianoff pointed out, that it's almost impossible from a six-seated position for a paramedic to reach everything and everyone they need to do. So it really implies that for good functional design in an ambulance, you need a degree of mobility, probably in the seat and possibly even in the patient. Move to the next slide. And here's just a snapshot of a study done by Jonas Lydon, a Swedish researcher for the Swedish government, where he's looked at identifying not just range of movement, but frequency of access. So he's trying to provide some quantification to that sort of those sort of reach envelopes that we've talked about in terms of not just the reach capability, but reach capability based on frequency of access. Next slide. Okay, so we need to put these elements in the context of automotive safety, and again, Jean sort of outlined those fairly neatly. But in summary, and to restate, the priorities really are forward and rearward facing seats, and quite categorically, I'm very comfortable stating that good design would not reflect any side facing seats during transit. I have been involved in the design of seats that we can activate to a side facing position, but the capacity to activate those seats is linked into the ignition of the vehicle, and so it's only possible to move those seats when it is to accessory or locked. It's not possible to do that during movement. Clearly, restraint of all persons and items at all time, and different jurisdictions have different restraint requirements. The European requirement is generally 10 Gs in all directions, so a G being if something weighs a kilogram, in a sudden deceleration or crash, that 1 kilogram becomes 10 kilograms. And in Australia, we have a requirement for 20 G in forward direction. So our bariatric vehicles, we've designed for 400 to 500 kilogram patient. We need to be able to resist them to the tune of 20 times those amounts. We bolt our bariatric patients to the floor because our capacity to restrain the ambulance stretcher on the floor is not sufficient at that. So the design challenge, again, as Jean indicated, is fitting the users, the occupants and the equipment within this space, but creating accessibility whilst retaining some sort of safety. We don't want people hitting their heads on inappropriate surfaces or their limbs, and really sort of working within those automotive safety basic principles. And ultimately, my belief is that requires a degree of mobility within the ambulance whilst adhering to those principles. Next slide, please. Thank you. And here's just an example of a very mobile seat. So if you see the occupant there, she's able to move forward. This is a neonate sort of device, and it gives her a great range of movement. There's a side-facing seat. Next slide, please. I'll just begin to wrap up here. Okay, so in terms of summary, I guess it's my experience and it's my desire to share that experience with this group that really the effective application of good ergonomics can really help define the system requirements in terms of what is happening in both a meaningful, useful way. And I think that can be predictive. And I've clearly demonstrated a project where we had to anticipate a scenario that we had no experience or expertise in. But the end result was, because we applied a good methodology, is I'm happy to say that I think we got it right, or fairly close to right. The strategies to adopt in terms of getting to that point were really task analysis. And you know, I would encourage people to, you know, think about making a cup of coffee in terms of all the different steps that are involved with that. All of those steps involve defining your interaction with that system. There's no shortage of data these days on understanding good body sizing in terms of cross-population, and that can feed into both past performance and biomechanics. And again, all of those elements have to be implemented in the context of inherent automotive safety. So you can get creative. It doesn't mean you can't do things. What it means is you can do things in terms of creative design, and it's creative design that's required to get good outcomes. And in my talk this afternoon, I hope to show you lots of examples of some of that creativity. Next slide, please. And that's the end of me. Thank you.
Thank you. Last speaker in this segment is Dr. Nadine Levick, and she'll tell us about information and technology transfer.
Well, sir, we're waiting for the slide to set up. I just want to say that Chris really touched on something that's really important, and I think he highlighted the importance of the seat. And I think whilst it is really, really key that we have some mobility, the mobility needs to be, as Chris has outlined, in the seat rather than getting out of the seat to do something, and that the design initiatives need to be designed around allowing you to do what you have to do whilst seated. So without further ado, I think I'm going to attempt to... there we go. I think I can turn the slides. I got the clicker. I've worked it out. All right. Well, I'm going to cover a little bit of technology transfer and how we move information from one discipline to another. And that was just a small example. Yes, we need to be able to reach our patient and do our work, but mobility doesn't mean mobility outside of the seat. It means designing the system so that you can reach what you need to reach and remain seated. And we're going to see some very creative ways how that's achieved. So I'm going to cover some information and technology transfer. New tools, new collaborations, new platforms, new events, new organisations, and some of the information we were talking about earlier, these social media technologies that allow sharing information across platforms and across countries and across the globe. The first very interesting platform is one we've touched on, this very group that allowed it possible for people already from a number of very diverse disciplines to meet, even from different parts of the world, using some technology to share their ideas. So this committee, which we didn't really talk in much detail about before, is an unusual committee because it's very interdisciplinary. It's a subcommittee of what's called the Transportation Safety Management Committee within TRB, and that's where our leadership comes from. We're probably a little unique within that group, given some of the specific challenges that we've discussed already and how we've tried to reach out to answer those. The committee is not been around for that long. I think Chris's mic might still be open. The committee has only been around really since 2007, and we had our first subcommittee meeting in 2008. Eileen Fraser, who's spoken here before, is the co-chair with me, and our scope is really all of medical transport safety. And as we said this morning, it's emergency medical services are one of the key pillars that have a special role in road safety and for the Transportation Research Board. I just thought I'd throw this up. This is just the agenda of our subcommittee meeting, and the reason I throw this up is I think this was a very good example of really knowledge transfer. We had about 16 people in the room that day, and we were had some highway people there, and we had some automotive people there, and we had some EMS people. But in less than 24 hours, 2,460 people had downloaded the handout that was discussed in that agenda. And I really think that's a very good example of knowledge being shared and information being translated. And again, I'm going to keep highlighting the research needs, because here we have an opportunity where we identify gaps in knowledge and areas that need research. We have an opportunity to bring those forward. So those of you who've got your research needs documents, please take some time to fill those out during the breaks or when something comes to your mind during the presentations. And there'll be an opportunity for you to email that information. We're going to be hearing shortly from some very sort of high-tech and cutting-edge information about how we can keep our roads and our drivers safer and how that applies to EMS and EMS's role in that. And the Rita ITS group at the DOT have been doing some, that's Intelligent Transportation Systems Research and Innovative Technology Administration. We're very fortunate to have Linda Dodge here with us to present some of the work that they're doing that links into some of the new technologies that are possible that we discussed this morning. We spoke briefly about the collaboration between the Department of Homeland Security, NIST and NIOSH, working together from a number of diverse disciplines trying to answer some of the questions that are being asked. This is another very recent initiative, and all these initiatives have really just begun in the last 12 to 24 months. This is the Traffic Incident Management Network, and this is, again, another interdisciplinary group of folks who embrace emergency medical services, fire and rescue, law enforcement, and all the other parts of highway safety, and are focused on the safety of the people that are part of that. So, again, interdisciplinary, a large virtual platform, sharing information. And the more it's easy to do that, the more we seem to see that it's possible to reach out to across broader audiences, comparing the 30 or so people that looked at our handouts in the first year or so to the 2,460 in 24 hours, and now well over 6,000 people have looked at that information. Another very valuable forum, and I was honoured to be asked to speak at the Traffic Records Forum. These are the people that help design how the data gets captured, a very key and crucial part of the big puzzle of understanding the scope of the problem and how best to engineer a solution. Been incredibly helpful to us. These are the people that are involved with writing the MUC recommendations and input into that infrastructure. Another group, and we're going to be hearing a little more about their activities very shortly, is the Society for Automotive Engineers. These are the folks who are involved on the hardcore engineering side of making vehicles safer for people in them and also for people outside them. And the American Society for Safety Engineers have a slightly different focus, more on the educational training side, implementing existing guidelines. There's this other organisation, I'll throw a plug out of that, because we seem to have made some good headway in this very task. That's a difficult task of bringing different disciplines together so that it's possible to actually be productive and to carry that information into practice. And this is an example of a small workshop, and the audience there has everyone from automotive engineers to EMS operational people to educators to industry, manufacturers, ergonomists, educators and trainers, and getting all those people into one room and speak a language that they all understand has its challenges. And there we saw Chris demonstrating at one of our workshops just some of those challenges. And at that same workshop, we have Jean discussing with an EMS provider from actually Alaska about some of the automotive design features. And this is a vehicle you're going to be hearing a lot more about. This is one of North America's most innovative fleets of ambulance vehicles. It's been built based on input from ergonomists and automotive engineers. I also want to show you another area where use of existing technology, and I have yet to have the privilege to be out there, but we'll get out there soon. This is a high-tech interactive innovation centre so that you can pilot test the equipment that you're looking to put in your vehicle and do that all with the use of social media technologies and wireless technologies. Very interesting use of existing media to try and facilitate sharing information. And really, not only is it across disciplines and moving from sort of ideas into practice, but it's also very international. And we've mentioned this event, this EMS Woodstock, that occurs in Germany, and it's the brainchild of Professor Seffrin, where we've had the honour to participate and be recognised there. It's a huge conference with 20,000 attendees and an opportunity to see and meet people from other parts of the world. And those of you who've been with us have realised it is a fabulous opportunity for knowledge transfer. And not only is it knowledge transfer, but you actually see Kyle Bates, who this morning was assisting us with our podcast. That's Kyle with the red mic there. And with the yellow mic is a Swedish industrial designer. And with the green mic is an American ambulance manufacturer. And those folks are all sharing ideas and practice. But they're not only just sharing it, they're recording it in a podcast so that anyone can share it. And we've made all these podcasts freely available to anyone so that you can have the benefit of that unique experience offline or online. And that's that shot, and that's a diagram. And that was an education for me. This is a way that ergonomists and industrial designers look at things. They put coloured dots that designate frequency of use. So, for example, if there's a white or a red dot on something, it means you infrequently would reach for it. If there's a green or a yellow or orange dot, you more frequently would reach for it. So this is a way of representing what Chris has talked to us about, task analysis, so that you can understand what is it that people need to grab for. I know even in the ER, when I'm setting up to do an IV, I know what I want, where, and with which hand, and I set my stuff up so it's going to be this. I'm not reaching behind my back or, you know, like the interns do, to grab something that I didn't position where I needed it to be. So really, in summary, I think the key issues that underscore effective knowledge transfer are collaboration that's got to be across disciplines, across agencies, and across nations. And I think now we've got the luxury that we can do that with the press of with the swipe of our finger over a smartphone. So thank you very much. And I think do we have questions now? We have questions before the break. So at this point, over to Dr. Cunningham to manage a question session.